This is the Tax Update Podcast for June 16, 2008. This week, we're going to take a look at who's knocking at your door. A presentation I gave at the Arizona Society of CPAs Financial Planning Conference in a breakout session. Tax Update Podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research confirmed by Ms. Brazen's presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. This week, we're going to go over a presentation that I gave at the Arizona Society of CPAs Financial Planning Conference in Phoenix last Wednesday. This particular one talks about some of the security issues we face on our computer systems in a financial environment. And it's a presentation that was of interest to those at that meeting, and I think of interest to all of us in the tax area. Reality is, those of us in tax practice have information in our files that literally is the mother load for purposes of stealing someone's identity or misusing the identity. Everything you need to take an identity is in most of our files for almost all of our clients. So we're going to take a look at what exposures do we have to our computer systems and maybe what we should be doing to take care of that. Now, when we talk about security, we have to ask a simple question: what good is a lock if everybody's handing out all the keys to the kingdom? And we tend to do that. Here's the hitch we have with computer securities. Our clients presume the information they give us will remain private and not be disseminated to the world. But as I noted, we have a lot of high dollar value information in our files, in the files in our firm. Information that can be sold easily on the internet and fetch a nice little price. Those who go after information go to the weakest point of attack that they can find. That means the weak point of attack in your organization is where the data will leak out through. And reality is, any user of a computer on your network is that potential weak point. In fact, it's almost certain that rather than the hardware or rather than some of the other equipment you have, the real way to get information out of your organization via the computer systems is to get someone in your organization to help you. That someone could be one someone who inadvertently manages to help us. It could be a number of someones. We can get a piece of information from one person, a piece from another, and move our way through and get the information involved. Or it could be the head honcho in our organization who simply is too busy and does too many important things to be bothered worrying about computer security. But whoever it is, it serves as the source for information to leave, because reality is, people are generally the weak link in computer security systems. Now, it's important to realize that we've had a significant change over the past decade or so. The primary motivation for going after computer systems is no longer like the old War Games movie that you may all remember from back many years ago, where the game was some teenager trying to hack into a government's computer system just for the fun of hacking in and playing games. No longer is this mainly a game of somebody just trying to show what they can break into or get bragging rights. Today, it's primarily for financial gain. The issues here are financially motivated, and the matters come to us in a cost-benefit ratio. They go after where they can get the most bang for their buck. They can get the most information with the least amount of work. Now, what we find here is we have four key exposures that we faced with. We're going to discuss today four ways that we might lose track of data and potentially expose our clients' information. We're going to talk about the physical loss of equipment. We'll also talk about the non-targeted random attacks that every machine that hooks up to the internet runs into. We'll talk about special problems posed by remote access, and we're going to talk about targeted attacks. Now, I should note, this week it will be especially important to go download the materials from my website, edzollers.com. If you go to the ezollers.libsyn.com site for the podcast, you'll find the link to the actual file here. The link to the file will have copies of the slides that were put on for this presentation. You may want to follow along with those slides as you listen to today's presentation. Now let's talk about loss of equipment. Key question, what's on your laptop? What's on your server? And what's on your phone? Now, the nice thing about loss and theft, shall we say, is that normally we do notice. If my server is gone, I'll probably notice I don't have a server if somebody broke into my building and took it. Similarly, if I went into the airport with a laptop, if I went into airport security with a laptop and I come out of airport security without one, I probably realize I misplaced my laptop is gone. Similarly, my phone. Eventually, I will have to replace my phone when it disappears. The hitch is, depending upon how these things happen, when they happen, and in what form, it may be quite a while before it's noticed. For instance, if your laptop is merely stolen from your hotel room, and you left the hotel in the morning at 8 a.m., you left the computer in the room, and you come back at 6, 7 that evening, the thief has had quite a bit of time to work with that particular device before we know it's stolen. Similarly, if your server is stolen on Friday night and there's no alarm or the alarm doesn't go off in your building, you may not know till Monday morning that you don't have a server. The other key thing is we are coming more and more with a number of very small, high capacity and low cost devices. USB thumb drives are ubiquitous. And those thumb drives these days carry gigabytes of information. It's not going too far to state that the thumb drive of today has more storage capacity than the servers for Fortune 500 companies had not all that long ago. We can walk off with an amazing amount of information can be stored on a thumb drive, a drive that may cost less than $10, and a drive that we may not initially worry about having available, or that we may just leave on our keychain when we give the keys to a valet to park our car, or when we put our car in for service. Portable hard drives have become more and more popular. Laptops never have enough storage room, and there's a nice big market in plug-in portable hard drives that plug straight into the laptop. Well, that little hard drive probably has more storage capacity than the drive in the laptop. And remember, the key issue with losing the laptop is not so much the laptop, but the data. And we may find out the data is even in an even smaller and even more portable format, and in a format where we may leave that data behind sometimes when we just take the laptop because all we're going to need to do is respond to some emails. So we leave all the client data sitting on a hard drive in the hotel room. Again, subject to be stolen. Ultra-mobile PCs have become more important and may have an increasing role. The Asus EPC has burst on the scene with this nice little 7-inch screen. Wonderful little device, but its hard drive, which is not really hard drive now, but a flash memory, may seem small by current standards, but still, gigabytes again, like the thumb drive, gigabytes of information, and in a format where we're going to probably copy that data onto that little device so that we have it available when we're, let's say, flying. The wonderful thing about the EPC is that when I'm on a plane, I can use it regardless of what the person in front of me does in terms of reclining their seat. The bad news is I probably have the client data right there on that machine and potentially didn't worry about whether it should be, how it should be secured. Cell phones carry more and more information. If nothing else, at least your contact list for all your clients, and I'm sure your clients don't really want their phone numbers handed out to everyone. But other information can be in your cell phone, including these days as phones get smarter, perhaps even login information to get inside to information inside your corporate network. Finally, portable media players have become smarter, and they can contain lots of information. The current version iPod Touch that Apple sells is really the equivalent of the Apple cell phone, the iPhone, with the same intelligence level and a mini computer type structure that can connect to Wi-Fi and have the same type of login information and contain address information and data, logins, emails, and all kinds of wonderful information. As well, these portable devices have storage capacity quite often that can function as a disk, which means that somebody coming in your office who's apparently listening to music on an iPod may surreptitiously be able to copy data straight over onto that iPod and walk out the door with it. Again, a problem you may not have thought about. Now, how do we handle security on these devices? Well, I think the most important thing to understand is you need to learn about and make use of encryption. Now, there is a danger of proprietary solutions, and it's kind of counterintuitive. You may think it'd be very useful to get your encryption that's secret and nobody knows how it works. First problem, somebody obviously does know, because if it works, there has to be a system to both encode, to both take the data, convert it into encrypted data, plus there has to be a method to undo that, and obviously that method is sitting in the code in the computer. Secondly, sometimes programmers sneak in back doors. Third, if encryption software is not done right, it can be worse than useless because it can be incredibly easy to crack. An example of that, not really dealing with encrypted data of the sort we'll talk about here, but an encryption system that many of us have run into, is the original wireless encryption protocol, or WEP, for securing Wi-Fi hotspots and Wi-Fi spots in your business. The WEP encryption system is so incredibly broken that it is in fact easier to get a computer on a WEP Wi-Fi system by simply loading up software that breaks into the system and comes up with the key to get in than it normally is to type in those super long keys for WEP. Only with the later WPA system did we get a really secure encryption system for working with Wi-Fi and keeping unauthorized users off the net if we have a secure password. A program you may want to look at for encrypting data is the TrueCrypt project, www.truecrypt.org. TrueCrypt encrypts data and stores it on a disk file on your hard drive. It is cross-platform compatible. There are TrueCrypt versions for Windows, for Linux, and for OS X on the Macintosh. As well, it works easily from machine to machine, and the code that and handles the encryption is open. Now, I said it was counterintuitive, but good encryption does not depend upon the method of encrypting being secret. Rather, it depends on the fact that the algorithms are such that without the key, it will be virtually impossible to decrypt. What that also means is that the best way to beat an encryption system that is at all decent, and obviously WEP doesn't qualify as that, but WPA would, is to know the key or have a key that's easily guessed. The real test for good encryption is that if we lost the key, we've totally lost the data. That's also a good test when you're told to encrypt data or a program claims to be able to encrypt it. You may notice lots of programs on the market that will claim to basically still allow you to read a password encrypted file if you, quote, forget your password. In many cases, those programs are just doing simple dictionary guess for a bad password. But if they truly can break any file, then that tells you the encryption's worthless, because what good is encryption when, if I pay $20 or $30, I can read that file automatically? There is operating system-based encryption that's important. Windows, OS X, both have them built into the system. You may also have seen the Lenovo fingerprint reader on Lenovo, and prior to that, the IBM ThinkPads. Lenovo bought the ThinkPad line from IBM. Laptops that swipe your fingerprint over and it decrypts a hard drive. There can be full hard drive encryptions in these systems. The advantage to such systems for the operating system level and for the other Windows systems and OS X, the encryption is based on your login password. So you provide the login password. Once you do that, it decrypts the hard drive. If you don't do that, the hard drive remains encrypted. The advantage is it's easy to use and automatic. The disadvantage is the same, easy to use and automatic. What's the problem? People walk away from machines. Once I have given the machine the key, if I lose control of that machine while it's powered up and running, the person that takes it, as long as they keep it powered up, and that may even include if they allow it to sleep, it may include it if it allows to sleep even with a password, depending upon certain structures and how we can access data and perhaps take over the machine, even though it supposedly is requiring a password to get back in. But if we let that machine out of our control while it's on, the bad guy can access the data still. There's also danger that in many cases, this thing will encrypt other devices, but when you plug them in, they automatically mount. Again, if we get control of the machine while it's on, I can read all the devices at the same time. Now, the key to any of these encryptions, though, that work is passwords. And good passwords are crucial. First key rule, password itself, not a good password. The sad fact is, the word password as a password works way too often. In fact, if you have a machine in front of you and you don't know what the password is to something and you need to get into that document or you need to get into that machine, there's a very good chance that if you just type the word password, you'll get in. Doesn't work in a majority of cases, but it works often enough as to not be a bad try. Other bad passwords. No dictionary words standing alone should ever be used as a password. It is trivial to write password crackers that simply try all dictionary words. Dictionary words are utterly useless as a password. As well, don't just use numbers. Unfortunately, a lot of people in tax practice seem to believe that a social security number is a wonderful password. Because, of course, the client won't let anybody else know that one who's not authorized to read it. Well, even presuming the client has let nobody else know their social security number, there's still a finite number of potential social security numbers, because there's only 9 digits. And it is trivial for a computer to simply try all 9-digit combinations to find the one that magically opens up the door. You need to be using combinations of words and numbers, preferably interspersed, and preferably not just words with a number right behind it, but something more complex. The one problem is the password needs to be memorable but not easily guessed. You may want to work up a system where you devise passwords that you can easily remember, but which would not be found by a simple dictionary attack or a dictionary attack that modified by simply adding some numbers on the back. I would also strongly suggest that if you do work a social security number into your password scheme for a client, that you don't just have that run of 9 digits come consecutively, that you at least break it up in some way and hopefully find some other method to encrypt that data. Finally, in your organizations, consider policy problems. Too often I can see policies that are well-intentioned, but tell us that our password should be not a dictionary word, that's good, should be a random set of numbers and letters, okay, that's fine. It should be changed every 2 weeks because that lowers the risk of if the password gets in somebody else's hands that if it's changed every 2 weeks, we limit their time frame. Okay, that sounds good. And it shouldn't be written down. That lowers the chance that the password won't be run into by somebody who opens up a desk drawer and reads the password and get in the system. The bad news is if you take the combination of all 4 of those things, I will guarantee you that one or more of them are being violated, and probably all of them, at least to the extent the system allows it. Because nobody can remember a random set of letters and numbers that changes every 2 weeks if they don't write it down. And if they do write it down, then they're beginning to violate the rules. Now it's a bad concept to have rules that everybody knows are being violated by everybody because they're unrealistic. At that point, not only do we not pay attention to the don't write it down rule, but now we believe all of the rules are irrelevant, which means all of them get worked around to the extent they can. What has been suggested by some, and was a suggestion that I heard once raised by a Microsoft representative, was that you should treat your password like you do a credit card. Your credit card number is written down on your credit card. But you make sure you know where that is and you keep it under your control. If you keep the password, you meet all those criteria, but you have your password with you and you control it like you do your credit card, reality is that most likely you're not going to face major problems and you'll have a very secure system to handle. The key thing I think you need to be aware of is make sure your password can't be easily guessed and make sure and changing it probably isn't a bad idea. But to do that, you probably do have to give up the don't write it down concept. And if you believe people aren't writing it down, you're kidding yourself. Now, another option for stolen equipment is remote wiping. That's a big option with cellular phones, especially ones like the BlackBerry that tend to have deep ties into your corporate information system. It is a useful option, but it's not good standing alone. At best, it's a damage control mechanism. Remember, we only know to hit the kill switch after we realize it's been stolen. So that's a problem already if it takes us a while to figure out something's been gone. And how many of us have not left our cell phone at home and we get to the office and we can't quite sure if we left it at home or not. We know it's not with us, but we think, I probably left it at home. What if it turns out you weren't right this time? You didn't leave it at home. You left it at the coffee shop. Now you got a problem. Especially when you finally get home, you probably look for it for a few hours. And then finally, after a day or so, you decide, well, it must have been lost. And only then do you kill it off and get rid of it. But at that point, if we tell the IT department to do the remote wipe, the crooks had it for a few days. As well, a technically competent thief may very well be able to disable the communication mechanism so that the device does not communicate back to get the kill mechanism sent to it. And finally, it's not really available except on high-end smartphones. The very basic, dumb little phones that many of us have may still have tons of data in it because we've synced up all of our contact information, so that's available when we're on the road. We can call our clients as need be by just simply telling our phone, you know, dial Joe. But we don't have any way to kill that off if that data falls into the wrong hands. Now, key issues for keeping things from theft is physical control. Airport awareness is significant, subject, of course, to the TSA issues we're all going to run into because we have to get through security. In the best case, make sure your laptop goes through security behind your case and any other carry-on items you have. In essence, you don't want your laptop to be the first thing out the other side right behind the guy in front of you's carry-on items. You'd prefer to have come out later, by which time hopefully you've cleared security. Don't release your laptop on the belt until the prior passenger has gone through the checkpoint if you can manage to do that. Why? An old trick used to be to send one guy through who cleared security. The next guy through would make sure he had something on him that would cause everything to beep and stop the security line. So security didn't go through, but the scanners were still running. That allowed the guy on the other side who'd gone through clean to pick up the laptop because they had found a mark out there that obviously was carrying a laptop and it was going to have to run it through security, and that would allow them to steal the laptop. Considering making your laptop distinguishable. Stickers, other things that will make it clear it's your laptop, maybe even a colorful case. There are, for certain computers, we still sell colorful cases that can go on. Something that would make it clear that's your laptop coming out the other side. As well, try to find a laptop case that doesn't scream laptop case. That helps lower the chances that somebody realizes instantly there's a laptop in that bag and ceases hopefully to make it not as high value a target or not a target that somebody latches on to instantly. As well, whenever you go through security or whenever you go away from your laptop, be sure it's off. As noted earlier, if we encrypt everything and then we just make sure that the thing isn't on, if that encryption is good, when the thief gets the computer, if they can't give the password, they're dead. And keep the device with you or off always when it's not. That's crucial. Know where the device is. Now let's talk about random attack, which is avoided calling in the hazmat team for your hard drive. They get the highest level of press coverage and the most widespread threat. But they're probably one of our least troublesome things generally, except indirectly, as they can be used to attack our system. The general goal of random attacks on the internet these days is to build a botnet that's used for an attack or to send spam. We can get thousands of machines to attack a site to bring it down, or we can use the botnet to send out spam, and spam is very much a thing that we're used to grabbing these machines. We also can use the botnet to be able to install servers on these machines we've taken over, and then use those for things like identity theft. Again, not a nice thing to discover that's going on, that the equipment on your site and on your network is being used to host a site that is being used to scam credit card numbers from individuals. The attack mode is normally we want to infect the user's machine, and once we do that, the machine then joins up on the botnet. It may also go find other nice pieces of malware to put on the machine too, because quite often these attackers are paid for the number of networks they can get this machine to be part of. The malware is meant to prevent detection. It really is written so it won't be noticed. It's also meant maybe to harvest data. Use a keystroke logger, and if it sees 9 digits that look like a social security number and a name, forward that on to a third-party site. This software almost always as well tries to disable any security software on your system, and unfortunately quite often is successful in doing so. When the botnet is activated, it sends out spam, it may attack other systems, or as I note, it may be used to host servers for things like running those fake websites that are used to steal credit card information or information that people think they're given to their bank. What's a high-risk machine for this attack? Unfortunately, it's a Windows XP machine, especially one that is connected directly to the internet, does not sit behind a router. Now, part of the reason why XP is attacked is the same reason the infamous statement that Willie Sutton probably never did make, but was quoted as making as to why'd you rob the banks? Well, that's where the money was. Why do we attack Windows XP machines? That's where all the people are and all the computers are. With XP, because it's going to be a target, the firewall should always be on. By default, Service Pack 2 installs with the firewall on. You should always keep the Windows firewall on. That's true even if your machine never leaves your network, and triply true if your machine ever goes outside the network and goes to coffee shops or any other place in the world, or uses something like a Verizon data card, Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, one of those data cards to connect to a network that way. Directly connecting to the network without a firewall is asking for trouble. Consider mandating the use of Firefox for browsing, except in those cases where Internet Explorer is required under Windows XP. If you have to use Internet Explorer, use Internet Explorer 7. Now, on Vista, I will tell you that Internet Explorer 7 may even be a preferable choice because of the way it runs. It works well. Unfortunately, with XP, it still has to run in a slightly less secure mode, largely because of the tight integration between Internet Explorer and XP. Explorer is the file browser. That particular design decision may have been one of the dumbest decisions ever made by Microsoft, and it's not a decision carried forward in Vista. Vista's file browser is separate. But because it would break everything, Internet Explorer 7 when running on XP still functions in that mode, and that gives it hooks deep in the operating system that can be exploited. Finally, if you're using Windows, and I know a lot of people won't like this one, but I think you need to consider it, consider using Vista. For all of the complaints I've heard about Vista, all the compatibility issues, one thing that's clear about Vista, it's a lot better from a security standpoint. There are a lot of design features that make Vista better. And if you don't turn off functions, Vista out of the box is relatively secure. Now, any machine connected to the net, even if not a Windows XP machine, is at risk in some form, and you need to be aware of that. Even more so, the favorite attack mode these days seems to be phishing. Now, phishing's not the 90s rock group, but the email-based scam. If you're looking at the handout materials or the materials I had for slides, you're going to see a copy of a website that claims to be Woodgrove Bank. Now, if you look at that particular slide, which is slide number 17 overall, you're going to find that there are two numbers there, number one and number two. Number one is the link shown in the email that says https://, and then a URL that appears to be for your bank. The bad news is, because of the way HTML email works, which is the email that almost everybody uses in Outlook, in almost any of the major email programs today, even web email, what that says isn't necessarily where it's going to send you. The actual link is shown with the 2 below. And that link sends you to a site that is 203.144.234.138. What does that site? That site may very well be an infected machine on a botnet that is used to harvest data and then forward it to a third party. Well, the problem is you're going to be sent there and you're going to give your information to that site. How do we prevent these problems and how do we keep this from happening? Simple rule, never under any circumstances click on a link in an email. Type in addresses. Type in, if you get an email claiming to be from Bank of America, claiming to be from Chase, claiming to be from First Union, claiming to be from whoever the bank may be, type in the bank's address in the URL bar, do a Control-L, and just type in the address, http://www.bankofamerica.com. Not that many letters to type. You can make that into a bookmark and then go to your bookmark. Do not click the link in the email. Always check the address bar. Make sure you are sent to where you thought you were going to be sent to. And follow up with the padlock. Check the certificate for all sites. Internet Explorer 7 and Firefox 3 offer heightened security on certain websites that have paid for a heightened certificate. In Firefox 3, you'll see a green indicator and a big one in the address bar when you're on a site that has paid for the secured site. The standard padlock just tells us somebody paid and got an SSL certificate. That tells us our data is going there encrypted, but doesn't tell us for sure who's on the other end of the connection. The green light tells us, because there are a limited number of entities that can issue that, that in fact, they have cleared hurdles to prove, at least to the satisfaction of outfits like VeriSign, that the entity in question is who they claim to be. Finally, Firefox 3 offers, if you click on the name next to that, it tells you which site is the one that claims to have the certificate, which is good, even if you don't get the green bar. And if you click on that, it gives you more information about that site. Very useful. Check that information, especially if you have any doubt whatsoever about what site you got sent to. Remember, phishing emails depend upon creating a panic in you that says, I must do this now. They tell you your account's been compromised and you need to act right now or all of your credit cards will be no good. That's meant to panic you to start working. Never react quickly to an email. Step back away from the computer and consider other ways of contacting the entity aside from using the methods specified in the email. If there really is someone fraudulently using your account, and Bank of America has noticed that, if you call the customer service line, they'll probably know about that too. Similarly, if you go directly to the Bank of America website by typing it in the address bar and log into your account, if they're notifying you by email of this problem, they're probably going to notify you on the website as well and have some issues there. Just consider, don't click on the links in the email. Now remember, antivirus and anti-spyware software is virtually useless for these non-targeted attacks. Why? It's reactive. They can only come out and scan for those things they know about. And the bad guys are working constantly and studying very carefully the anti-spyware and antivirus software out there to find the holes in them that they can work around for a while. The real key is behavior determines who gets infected. If you go to untrusted websites, if you go and click on links in emails, if you don't keep your computer updated with the latest security releases from Microsoft and your other vendors, you're far more likely to be infected. One key issue that we know is a problem, enticing people to sites with drive-by web attacks. Unfortunately, pornography sites are one of the big areas for such infections. And the bad part is, the reason they're so popular is you get people to go there and people cover up the fact they've been there. And it's very easy to do a drive-by and drop in using the browser's bad behavior. That's another reason why it might be useful to use a browser other than an Explorer. Again, the Willie Sutton effect here, Internet Explorer is used by most users. That's what's going to be most targeted. If you're using Firefox, your targeting is less. If you're using Opera, the targeting is even smaller. An infected machine, once it's infected, can never be trusted again until you reformat the hard drive and start over reinstalling the operating system from scratch. With Windows, that's going to mean, essentially, reinstalling every program that's been on that machine. So it is a real pain to go back and do that. The random attackers, as I say, quite often are looking primarily at forming a botnet and sending out spam or other things like that. But they still do things like install keystroke loggers to harvest any information they can find on the machine, and those loggers and scanners can do damage by sending client information on to those third parties, so we do need to be concerned about these systems. Another way you can try to handle this situation is either get rid of Windows XP, and by that I mean go ahead and move on up to Vista, or box Windows XP in. If you have to run XP, we can talk about virtual machines and their use. If you're in Arizona in July, I'm going to do a two-hour presentation for the Arizona Society on virtual machines and their uses. You want to come by and look at that. I personally run Windows XP in a virtual machine under Macintosh OS X operating system. And I do that so I can keep XP boxed in, use it for the limited features I need, which generally is my tax software and certain other items, but then do my browsing and other dangerous activities. And by the way, browsing is one of the most dangerous activities out there, along with email, under OS X, largely because most of the bad things out there aren't trying to infect OS X. Okay, next in line, we can look at remote access issues. This is giving up client information with your latte or while you're at the hotel. Now, we've talked about this one before, so I'm going to go over it rather briefly. We had a previous podcast on this, but we've discussed about the fact that Ethernet presumes a trusted networks. When you have untrusted networks, when you connect to a network other than your own, you enter into dangerous territory. There are two key things that can be used to attack you. In some cases, in fact, about half the cases in a hotel network, simple packet sniffing is all that needs to be done to get information that you're transmitting over the internet. In other cases, I should say, and that's only hotel networks, but also any Wi-Fi hotspot. Man-in-the-middle attacks can occur even if we're on a switched network, and that's the second way we can be attacked. Now, to be a secure transmission, we have to ensure that data remains encrypted all during the transmission period and that we know the endpoint we're sending to is the one we think we're sending it to. That requires authenticating who's on the other end decrypting. Now, we talk about hubs versus switches, and for those of you who are aware, most of us should be, a lot of us here should be, in a hub connection to a network, everything gets transmitted out to all the computers connected on the network. So if I send a piece of data, it goes out to everyone. On a switch, generally, though not always, only the address-specific material sent to gets the material. In the hub mechanic, if I transmit for client D, and if you look at my picture here, it's on slide 24, I've got traffic for D, it goes to the hub. That traffic transmits out to all of the four clients. In a well-behaved system, everybody else ignores it, and only client D, who is the client that was supposed to get it, acts upon that data. With a switch mechanic, I send my traffic for D back to the switch, but this time it transmits it to D, and clients B and C don't see anything. As you might guess, that certainly sounds better. Now, most new wired equipment these days are switches. However, hubs used to be significantly cheaper because they can be dumber. They just send out to everybody. They don't have to know who's on each end of the connection. A significant number of hotel high-speed networks use hubs, and wireless networks are, and have to be by their very design, hubs, essentially. Now, hubs are subject to just simple what's called packet sniffing. In this case, a rogue client doesn't ignore data that's not for it. It carries it, logs it, and may even and then analyze that data later to find out, hey, were there social security numbers in here? Was there sensitive information? Was there account numbers? Were there email logins in there? Most Ethernet cards can be set to promiscuous mode. So it's very likely that the Ethernet card in your machine can be set to work for this. Software exists to turn on that mode in your card and then log and analyze all data on the network. Now, a security expert who hooked regularly into hotels found about half of hotel networks were hubs, and when she hooked into a hub on the average evening in a large hotel, she would be able to get 80 unique email addresses and logins from the hotel's guests. Packet sniffing can even analyze some not-so-secure, supposedly secure systems. There were some versions of Windows Remote Desktop where the security encryption system didn't work so well. Remember our danger of proprietary networks, proprietary encryption. And it turns out it was breakable. If you had to be running one of those old versions of Windows Remote Desktop, your supposedly secured session isn't secure, and people could read that using this sniffing tactic. What can they get? Well, email logins are normally sent in the clear. If you don't know that your email has been configured to be secure, and never presume it has unless you know. If you're thinking, I think it has, answer is, it's not. If you're saying, I know it's secure, yeah, we're okay. Because if you know how to do it, if you really know, it's not one of those things you just presume it would have been set up that way. The default in almost all cases is email is sent non-secure unless you take special steps. All other data that's sent over the internet non-secured, non-encrypted, will be able to be sniffed. That includes communications with websites that are not connected via SSL links. And you can analyze secured traffic where you can break it. How do we solve this problem? VPNs are one of the best solutions to get back to your home network if that's the way that's what you're trying to do. A VPN does an excellent job of authenticating that who's decrypting this is who you think it is. And a VPN encrypts the data going from point A to point B, making it just garbage for the guy who intercepts it. There are public VPN networks you can use if your primary concern is trying to make sure the hotel guest can't read your email. You're not trying to get back to your main network, but you're trying to just read your email on your ISP. You may look at those. Finally, consider using SSL websites. And that may be especially true for email logins if you have a web-based email. If they offer you a secured method, usually HTTPS, go ahead and use that as your way to log in the site rather than straight HTTP. If your connection is secured, a padlock should appear in your browser. If you don't see that padlock or you don't see this thing locked down, you have a problem. One hint for those of you that use Google Mail, if you log into Gmail with https://mail.google.com, you will stay encrypted all the way through. If you log in http://mail.google.com, while your initial login will be encrypted, everything else will go unencrypted. You want to make sure you've stored your bookmark for Google and Gmail for Gmail as the HTTPS version. Now, a Wi-Fi access point poses exactly the same problem, and it's regardless of whether you're using encryption. WEP and WPA do not solve this problem. Why? Everybody on the network has the key. WPA, when it works, keeps outsiders from getting into the network, but does nothing to help with the people on the network, people who we may not trust. For instance, down at the Arizona Society of CPAs, they will tell you if you get on their location, they will give you the local network name and they'll give you a login, which is an encryption login. But it's used primarily to control access to the network, so only people who are authorized get in. But all of us who are logged into that network can read the data transmitted by anybody else transmitting on that Wi-Fi network. Nobody is suggesting that that network is secured, at least from the standpoint of the fact that anybody else in the room who wanted to basically grab the traffic could grab and analyze it. That's not a fault of the Arizona Society of CPAs setup. There's no other way to run a Wi-Fi hotspot. If you're going to run one, it's going to be this way. What it means is we need to be aware we're on Wi-Fi of that problem. The problem with Wi-Fi is there's no direct wire back to the client. Now, what about the switches, though? Remember those wired switches? They seem to be perfect because, you know, the bad guy never sees the traffic. Well, we can use a different issue with Ethernet to get around that. Now, your machine has what's called a MAC address, and that's used to uniquely identify it. Every machine, every Ethernet card has a unique MAC address. No two are the same. The MAC addresses are used essentially, it uniquely identifies your machine. But for actual routing of data to your machine, you're assigned what's called an IP address. And machines maintain a table of the equivalent IP address back to the MAC address. Your IP address changes constantly. When I log in here at my home, I've got one IP address. When I go back to my office, I get another IP address. When I log on to Verizon, I get a whole different IP address assigned to my machine versus the one I had when I was logged on to my home network or my office network. Now, an internet gateway is used to actually get data from inside our local network to the one outside. And when I log on to a network, I'll get the IP and MAC address for that particular location when I enter it. I'll be told where to send my data if I want to go to the outside world. The gateway then gets my IP and MAC address. So in the right working world, where everything's working right, I send my data to the switch for the internet. The switch knows it should go to the gateway. It assigns it back to, it's been told to go to MAC address D. It goes there in my particular design here, my example here on number 37. When the data comes back from the internet, it goes to the gateway. The gateway said, hey, that came from MAC address A here in slide 37. Therefore, it goes back to me. Now, what a bad guy can do is deceive us because we're trusting and we can change the gateway. The bad guy tells my machine that it's now the gateway address 192.168.1.1 on slide 38. It tells the gateway it's now my machine and sets itself up in the middle to receive the data. Slide 39 shows how this works. When I want to send information to the internet, I send to the switch and tell it to go to what I think is the gateway, which is really the bad guy. The bad guy receives my data, logs it, then sends it right back out to the real gateway, which gets to the internet. When the data comes back, the gateway sends it back to the bad guy because that's where it came from. He then logs the return data and then sends it back to me, sitting himself in the middle, thus coming up with what's known as the man-in-the-middle attack. What are the solutions? Well, if you can authenticate, that's a key way to get around man-in-the-middle. That is, you need to prove by authority or SSL certificates that the guy on the other side really is who we think he is, because that's the key to man-in-the-middle. Who's the person sitting there getting the data? If it's encrypted, and if I'm sure the party on the other end is the one that I think I should be talking to, then man in the middle can't work. You should always presume there is a man in the middle, and essentially your solutions are the same as with the hub. The VPN is great for doing that, SSL websites. A key factor to realize is if you connect to an SSL, a secured website like Amazon, let's say, to check out from Amazon, and you're presented with a notice telling you the certificate is invalid, do you want to accept it? That's telling it your machine doesn't accept this as being a valid Amazon certificate. If you say, go ahead and accept it, you will be in trouble because you just accepted the man in the middle's fake certificate. Rather, that's your key that there might be something going on with your data. But if you SSL connect out, no problems to Amazon, then you should be fine for man in the middle, at least outside of your own, outside of a corporate network in a large company where there might be some proxying going on that may have changed your certificates on your machine. But we won't talk about that one too much because that's probably not our main issue here, our main interest. Now, when you're on the road, you might consider that EVDO or HSDPA, the access modes for the wireless network cards that plug into your system and use the cell phone networks, may be a solution. And they do definitely get around these problems. The big hitch, though, is to remember that when you do that, your machine's going to be directly connected to the internet. That means consider all the remote access problems and the attack points we talked about earlier, the fact that you need to have your firewall set up and in good shape. Now, note, some newer phones can function as an EVDO or HSDPA modem, even if you don't have a separate data card, so you may want to check into that if your phone, in fact, has EVDO or HSDPA capabilities. It usually requires an additional payment to your carrier to use it as a modem, but it may be a more economical solution if you don't often need to use remote access. Finally, let's talk about targeted attacks. When someone knows who you are and what the prize is. Targeted attacks are more dangerous because there's no security through obscurity option, and it often makes use of social engineering along with other techniques. Now, all computer systems can be broken. There was a pwn-to-own contest at CanSec West in beginning of this year, 2008. The key game in that particular situation was, a bunch of computer security experts in the audience, was that they were to break into one of three computers, and if they did it, they would get the computer. That's the pwn-to-own theory. Pwn being P-W-N is the way that's spelled, and it means somebody taking over the computer. There were three computers in play, a Fujitsu U810 running Vista Ultimate Service Pack 1, a MacBook Air running OS 10 version 10.5.2, and a Sony VAIO running Ubuntu Linux 7.1. There were sets of rules here. 3 days this went on. On day one, it would be an outside attack on the operating system. You could not require the user to do anything. The machines would just sit there passively, and they would have to try to attack them. They would all be the standard installs out of the box for the three operating systems. You could not require running any program other than to boot up the operating system for the attack. The good news was, on day one, no computers succumbed. Day two, you can use any program that was included with the operating system installation, and you could ask the user to do minor things like visit a website or enter an address, you know, click on a link in an email. And day three, you could use major third-party software along with those who are part of the operating system, for instance, Adobe's Flash. As I noted, on day one, no machines were compromised. On day two, the MacBook Air was compromised using QuickTime and Safari exploit. Now, that would be of interest to Mac users because, of course, the theory is Macintoshes supposedly don't have problems with this stuff. Well, obviously, we had a problem here. Day three. The Vista machine was broken using Flash, same sort of instance, but used Flash to run it. Interesting aside, in both cases, it was a media player program that was used to bust the machine. That's somewhat scary because that's exactly the sort of thing you probably entice people. How many times have you seen people in your office who get an email about, oh, go see this funny video? Interesting bit. Note that both cases, the breaking came with the type of software that's used routinely to run that video. Only the Ubuntu Linux never got compromised. So is the answer to this that we should all go get an EPC, which runs a different version of Unix, and we should all convert and reformat our hard drives to run under Unix or run under Linux? Probably not. The Linux box was the most secure, and I think that's because both it is more secure than the alternatives, and honestly, there's not as much experience breaking into it. But, nevertheless, given enough time, you probably can break into it. And all of them can be broken into with sufficient user help. Ubuntu Linux's main advantage is that it's very consistent about requiring that users give the administrator password before you can do anything on the system. And Ubuntu Linux actually simply disables the root user. Virtually completely. It's tough to run a real root under Ubuntu. Now, targeted attacks are a risk for all entities. Machines that are kept current are at a lower risk level. Remember, none of these machines could be compromised without help from users. None of them that were on current versions of the operating system with a bunch of experts who know every trick in the book to get into a system, none of them were compromised until we could get users involved and help the process along. User training is a key. Why is that a problem? Social engineering. Social engineering gets users to reveal information. Hopefully it's not noticed, and it can enable the long-term use of data. Kevin Mitnick, who was convicted in some well-known trials for being a famous computer hacker back about a decade ago, has said more than once that almost none of what he did had to rely upon breaking into systems in the way of getting around technical controls. Rather, he found his most effective technique was always dealing with people and convincing people on the phone that would give him the information that would simply hand him the keys to get into the system. As I said, don't worry about breaking encryption if somebody just gives you the passwords and the keys. Now, there are a few types of attacks here that are involved in this social engineering. We have pretexting. That's posing as someone the attacker is not to gain information. I call up on the phone. I claim to be from, let's say, running a survey. I ask your receptionist what version of operating system is he or she using, and they'll tell me. I walk them through maybe some help about to find out what it is, what version of word processor, etc. Maybe I ask them, you know, who provides their service? Who does their computer service? And if they know that, I get that information or find out who does and move my way through. Then I can call later somebody else in the organization and be posing as somebody from the computer support firm saying, you got a report that there was a problem. Somebody's having a problem with the network and it wasn't real clear what it was. You're going to hit somebody's having a problem. And you get them to help you and eventually get their passwords, etc. Move your way up and get the information you need. Phishing, as we talked about earlier, works just fine. And in a corporation, it can be spear phishing. What does that mean? I can design an external website that looks like your internal intranet sites, and I may very well be able to get your employees to give me information they think staying inside the building when I'm well outside the building. Phone phishing. I can use a phone system to create legitimacy. I can use, you know, dial this number, send an email to dial this number. I can then have people give me all kinds of information through automated systems, presenting a system that looks almost identical to the type of phone system you'd expect at a legitimate bank. A Trojan horse. That's a program I send somebody that they download on their computer and then run. Now, they do that because they think it's nice, the dancing bunny video we're going to send you, or because they feel they have to. In a case that I found out about when we were on the California Society's listserv, we had the case involved of a scam that went on early this year where CPAs were targeted. And the email was one that said, you know, that appeared to be a letter going out to a client or potential clients of yours saying, you know, have you had contact with this particular CPA, name the person, and said, you know, we are, you know, the FBI, the IRS, whoever, we're investigating for tax fraud. For information on the type of issues we're looking at here, please open up this document, which would claim to be a PDF. Well, it wasn't. It was an executable. If you opened that, and obviously the whole point of this was to get CPAs scared and get them to open it, you ran the Trojan horse, which then compromised your system. Road apples are interesting too. What's a road apple? That's when I get access to the building or maybe out in the parking lot, and I leave lying around something that looks like a company CD or maybe a thumb drive that appears to have really juicy information on it, perhaps confidential information, that I'm pretty sure somebody will take in and attempt to read on their computer. Of course, what's really on that disk or drive, CDs and USB drives can be set to auto start. Most Windows computers will automatically run certain programs on those devices when they come up. Because of that, the mere act of inserting the CD in the drive in most configurations will cause the program to run, which can cause the infection to go in right away. At the same time, the person thinks they're merely reading a data drive and accessing data on the machine. For those who remember the infamous Sony rootkit case that was on the CDs that had a nice little problem for Sony that was incredibly embarrassing, the Sony audio CDs actually used this form of attack. In essence, what they did was installed software they weren't really telling you about when you inserted the CD into the drive. Quid pro quo. We do a trade-off with your people. Maybe, like the guy I mentioned on the phone who solved your network connectivity problem, I solve your network problem, you give me your login credentials. That's one you won't even notice that you made that trade. Or maybe it is a straight and pure bribe. Turns out most people willing to give up their login credentials, or claim they are, for very, very low price, like a ballpoint pen. Social engineering's goals is to get information. What can be very important information but that seems innocuous to your users may be things like who are the hardware vendors you use, what software and versions are in use, logins or data from which we can derive passwords, like I know somebody's probably using their name, somebody's probably using password, maybe I just need user accounts. Social engineering is more effective the larger an organization is. With the information they gain, they find exploits that will work. Their goal will be to launch an attack, keep a low profile. They may discover that some of those things we talked about that are remote access, some of the botnet programs, some of those older infection programs just open themselves up to allow other things to be installed. You can actually be able to scan the network to see if there's an infected computer, and if there is one of those, you can use one of those open botnet programs to put your own infection on the machine. And since many machines automatically trust machines on the network, that's especially true if you're not running Windows Firewall on each machine inside your network, it may be dirt simple for a machine once infected to infect every other machine on the network. Potential attackers who want you because you have financial data, obviously identity thief market participants will be very interested if they know they can get to your system, and your competition might be interested in you. Overall, what can we do? Educate your users is the number one thing. Make sure they don't behave badly. Keep your systems updated. That means your operating systems. Windows Update should be sent to run automatically. Make sure your users are running it. Make sure it happens. I know there is a risk it will brick the system. In fact, one of my partners had her system bricked, her previous system not really totally bricked. We were able to reinstall Windows and restart it, but certainly made unbootable after running Windows Update once. After that experience, she, of course, doesn't want to ever run Windows Update again. The problem is that's not an option. You have to do it. Even though we said that the virus checkers and the anti-spyware checkers aren't useful by themselves, you still want to have them loaded. They serve as a second line of defense. If they can catch old attacks, and reality is attacks never die on the internet. So it will prevent you from doing, it may help you from doing something incredibly stupid if that incredibly stupid something is an attack that the antivirus software already knows about. However, your behaviors have to stop you, but still, it's very important as a backup to have these in place. And finally, keep your application programs updated. Many users neglect to update their applications. Applications can be used just as effectively as the operating system to infect your machine. For resources to consider on the last page of my slides, consider going to CERT.org. That is the Computer Emergency Response Team site of Carnegie Mellon University. That has lots of information about security problems, issues on systems. That's a nice place to go. As well, a podcast we've talked about before is Steve Gibson's Security Now podcast. You'll find that at www.grc.com/securitynow.htm, or just Google for Security Now podcast and you'll get to his site. There is archived a lot of discussions about various security issues that you might want to review and keep up with. Security is our responsibility because our clients expect their data to remain confidential when we get it. For that reason, we need to make sure we follow proper security protocols. Now, this has been the tax update for this week, even though we didn't really deal with taxes this week. The tax update, as I say, we do this one every week. I am going to be doing two presentations this week, one for a state society, one inside a firm. The state society presentation is on the tax practice standards and Arizona ethics as it relates to tax practice standards for the Arizona Society of CPAs. That's coming up on Tuesday at the Arizona Society office. If you're listening to this before Tuesday, there still may be time to get into that class. If not, we'll see about doing it again next year. If the society's interested and I'm still doing this stuff, we may do it again. Otherwise, though, come out and I'll see you Tuesday. Also, my next presentations after that, I'm going to be going to the Prescott Estate Planning Council, and I'll be doing a presentation there and a presentation the next day to the Los Angeles chapter of the California Society of CPAs. Both of them will be on Statements on Standards for Valuation Services number 1 and how it impacts, in the first case, estate planning, and in the second case, tax practitioners in general. So we've got those going on. If you're either in the Prescott area with Prescott Estate Planning Council, or you're a member of the California Society and you're in the Southern California area, you may want to consider attending those meetings. Finally, I hit the road for actual CPE courses for state societies. First, for the Missouri Society in August is my first time I begin to hit. There I do IRS practice and procedures, and I do a partnership course. The Tax Update podcast, as always, has been brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limebergservices. Limeburg Information Services has email newsletters of interest to practitioners. Be sure you consider subscribing to their services at www.limebergservices.com. This has been the Tax Update.